Now, we get to draw on your wisdom and your questions that you're going to pose to the panel. So we'll go brick by brick. I'll come around. This is a microphone, so if you talk into it,
it might make a crackle sound.
It'll amplify it. So hold it
right in front of your mouth like this, so you can eat it.
So hold it out here, just about here. And then everyone will hear what you've got to say. So, I'll ask for a representative from each group. If you can say your name, just your brother's name, and then ask the question. So, group one. Who's our group one rep at?
She's there.
Okay.
How do you stand up as well?
Hi, my name's Arthur. And my question is, do refugees with disabilities have a hard time to get out of the camp and reach our country?
Yes. Australian government give more preference for this and UNHCR, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, this organization also sent more like disability and vulnerable like this kind of refugee in Australia. Because here is like health facilities and other facilities are poor than others compared to other countries. This is the thing.
Can I answer as well? It depends on the disability. If the disability, it means that the person is unable to earn a living and is likely to be a drain on the finances. The government is likely to avoid giving them a visa. And the issue with the people coming from Bhutan, I think, is that they brought the whole camp. And it is a major advantage. But with the Kosovars, there was one family that had a child with a cerebral palsy, and the Tasmanian government actually offered to fund this family because the government, Australian government, was not going to give them a visa. So it depends on the disability. You might have just a limp, but you'll be able to work, you'll be right. But if it's going to mean you're a dependent, you won't get in. And that might be your child. The whole family can't come because who's going to leave a disabled kid in a refugee camp? Yeah.
Anything else? No. All right, group two.
Hey, I'm Doug. Is Australia becoming a more attractive place for refugees? If so, why?
Where is?
Go on.
Your turn. Is it Australia or?
Yes. Go on, Marita.
it's really hard to gauge that, but I suppose we can just look at the statistics, and some of those were given to you earlier. And I guess Australia is amongst the countries that is accepting refugees. However, it's not the top country, so in terms of numbers, we're still not accepting as many refugees as some of the other countries. I suppose I'd like to ask Chura, when you were thinking about the possibility of going to another country, what were some of the countries that you were considering?
It is depend upon individual persons, refugee persons, what they are thinking. But what I am thinking for this one is Australia is the best place, I am thinking. It is the best place for me, my family, and other my family background, these everything's being me Australia, because it is a suitable for. And other thing also, climatic condition also there, these things coming here. So I prefer Australia like in this way. not other like someone say that you must go there. No. India rules, UNHCR rules, yes, they propose the country, you can go there, but if I deny, I should not go there, then UNHCR say, oh, okay, you can, you don't go. Like these sort of things there. And I feel Australia is best. That is why I'm coming here.
Again, talking with people who are applying for visas, and I get letters perhaps two or three a week from people saying, I'm in a refugee camp, I need to leave, can you help me? And you're hearing amazing stories. They don't care where they go, as long as someone, they've often applied for three or four countries because they're the countries that are taking refugees. They just need to get to safety. They're not actually saying, oh, you know, when I grow up, I'll go and live in Australia. It's more about where in the world can I go that will be safe and where I will get in. So, I mean, the media and the publicity, we're so arrogant to actually think that everybody wants to live in Australia. The people who come here are often appalled at our standards and what we do. So I don't think... The media would love to think that we're in great danger of being overwhelmed. The 13,500 is a static figure. It has been like that for the last 10 years. It's not likely to change because of the politics. And I think it's no more attractive. In fact, they're working quite hard to make it unattractive.
And, sorry, I'm just thinking of comparing refugees from a warm climate, refugees from an African country applying to go somewhere to be safe. And Finland, country I was born in, takes refugees. Now, Finland, the last time I visited in midwinter, had minus 28 degrees in the south of Finland. And I'm just thinking, the refugees that I met while I was there, who spoke to me, said that they felt safe there. So it didn't matter whether the climate was hot or warm. They were safe. They felt safe. So as Penny said, it's about being safe, whether you go to Finland or Australia. It doesn't matter. The important thing is that you can finally feel safe.
In relation to that question and some statistics, it may not be spot on, but for example, Australia actually takes in far fewer refugees than any other country. This is taken from the Refugee Action Coalition information data, and it is 2011 data. And I quote, Pakistan has 1.7 million refugees, Iran just over a million, and Syria 1 million. Other Western countries take far more refugees per head of population than we do. The United Kingdom has 270,000 in 2010, and Germany had more than 500,000 in 2011.
So in contrast, that with our 13,000, and you see how the refugee queue is not that aggressive. All right, group three. Who's representing? All right.
My name's Stephanie. Why does Australia and four other countries take the refugees and the rest of the countries in the world don't?
Oh, just got
okay. It's because we actually have an active program. The other people take them, but they don't have an active program. Australia has an active program of taking refugees, as has America and Finland and other Scandinavian countries. Countries like England, France, Italy take far more refugees, but there's no way of managing the numbers that arrive. They just... Everybody that turns up, they accept. Australia have got this box. You've got to fit in the box and then you can come. And that's possible for us because our boundaries are these big oceans. And we can say who will get here because you have to have a visa. but other countries are looking to copy our idea of having a quota and actually processing people so that they're welcome rather than everyone who arrives is illegal. We worry about illegal immigrants here. It's nothing compared to what most European countries are coping with, let alone Afghanistan or people going to Pakistan or elsewhere. Does that answer your question?
Bruce, what about in the 1950s during the Bonegilla era?
In what way?
In a similar question, answering the question that was posed, but instead of in relation to now, in relation to the 50s.
It's very similar to today. We had an active program. We wanted to increase the Australian population, and therefore we took in refugees and migrants. And in the post-war years, there was an enormous number of refugees in Germany and the places around Germany. And we relieved Europe of that problem, surplus population, which was also the feelings in the Netherlands and Italy and Greece. They thought they had too many people. Australia thought it had too few people. And they came as migrants. The refugees were refugees from communist-dominated places like Czechoslovakia and Hungary, and the displaced persons at the end of the war.
My grandparents on my mother's side were two of those people from Ukraine as well, who came at that time.
And did they come Bonegilla?
No, they came through the Adelaide camp. But I think there was only three in Australia, wasn't there? Bonegilla, Adelaide, and one in Perth. And half of them came through Bonegilla, if I remember you telling me correctly once. All right, well done. Good question, Stephanie. Group number four. All right. Can you catch?
Yes, I can.
Oh, sorry, please.
What did he say?
Being a 14-year-old, 15-year-old.
How is your personal view?
What's your name? Name?
Oh, yes, I'll name you.
Good.
Sorry. How has your personal history changed how you view refugees?
Your personal experience, is that what he's saying?
Personal history or personal experience?
Personal history.
Of someone here who's been looking at other refugees. Or a refugee person.
Yes.
This question is for me.
Experience.
No, experience.
Your personal experience.
Miss Deja Gilbert.
No, that's a good question. I think it's related to someone whose family has been from Australia for a long time. How does their family background bear out on how they view new refugees? Is that where you come from?
That'll do.
I think they're talking about the personal experiences of the panel.
How they view
refugees based on their own personal experience.
That's an even better question.
Yeah. Right, go on, Marie.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll go in this order then. I'll start first. I guess I've always been accepting of people from other backgrounds, other experiences, and that was something that came to me very strongly from my family background. I have heritage from the Gypsy group. My grandmother was a Gypsy descendant, and the Gypsy people around the world are displaced people. They often don't have their itinerants. So from very childhood I was taught to accept people and to help people and to get to know people on a one-to-one basis. So in that sense it hasn't changed a lot. What has changed though is the opportunities that I have had to meet people who have really, really hard life experience behind them, and the opportunity to be able to work with them to try and help them make a better future and a better life for them. So that experience has often been really, really powerful, and has ended me in being tears by listening to those stories. So I guess that's the thing that's really changed me in the sense of working with human beings who've had powerful life experiences.
Yes. I have one, my experience as I was a refugee. And I have a lot of experience about within a day sometimes. That kind of experience I have, I slept on the floor also, same days, and I went to the 5-star hotel also, same day. That kind of experience. See, within same day, I slept on the floor, and again the same day at the evening, I slept in the 5-star hotel also. How that life balance at that time. This kind of experience I have. And this means what I want to say is that what I have and what I don't have. That's the thing. Whatever things I have, I should satisfy to manage things that one and go ahead. That's the things. This is my experience. And another experience, changing all the time. Life changing now. I have one experience when I was in Bhutan, and another experience I was in refugee camp, and another experience when I was here now. Like changing one, adapting one. And I accept the changing and adapt the things and going on. That's the thing for my life.
My experience, Adrian, is indirect. My great-great-grandmother came out as an Irish convict, and the family historians in my family are very interested in following through a long Anglo-Celtic association with Australia, but still a migrant association. I grew up in Wollongong, which had a large number of immigrant people. When I was in your year at school, my friends were Dutch and German and Estonian. My first girlfriend was a Dutch girlfriend, and I remember going to her place and learning something about her culture, and the same with all my friends at that. Even more indirect, I suppose, is for a long number of years now, I've been in Albury Wodonga, and I've been trying to find out what I can about the Bongilla Reception Centre. And that involves me in going off to Canberra and sitting in the director's office at Bongilla by looking through the records, the correspondence, the photos, the applications he had dealing with migrant issues. So as an historian, I've had contact with refugees and immigrants. As a young boy growing up, I had contact with a large number of immigrants in the Wollongong district.
Okay. Well, like Bruce, when I grew up, three-quarters of the school population had names like Zelikovsky or Roverato or funny names, and they many of them had all minimal English when they arrived at school. And so I grew up in this environment of people who'd been displaced. Also, my mother was born at the beginning of the First World War, and one of her games as a little girl used to play being a refugee, which is quite fascinating. But she grew up in a world where the world she grew into was a world talking post-war about displaced people. And so she used to practice. That was one of her games, being a refugee. And I'm sure that had an influence on me. The other issue is that my great-great-grandmother was only 13 when she arrived on a prison ship from England, having stolen a dress and being sentenced to death. And so thinking about what a 13-year-old might find by herself in a country that had only been settled 2 years before, and how she survived to die at 84 with 300 descendants, had fascinated me throughout my childhood. As I said to the previous group, my job as a counsellor, I always saw as people, I was talking to people who had babies that had died, husbands that had developed brain tumours and dropped dead in front of them. And I was talking in my career about how to live in, with the what can only be described as the shit of life, the things you don't want to have. And if possible, how to live with it, and if possible, turn it into fertiliser so that it becomes something you grow through. And so the refugee experience is very much the shit of life. And so when I had the privilege and the opportunity to actually meet people with refugee backgrounds at that time when they were managing to survive and get through, it just felt right.
Well, this, I might tell the story of my grandparents from Ukraine. My grandmother was born in a village in the, what's now the west of Ukraine, but when she was born in the early 20s, it was part of Poland. And when she was 10 or 11 years old, the army of the Soviet Union came into that area, kicked everyone off their farms, and they had nothing to live on. Not long after that, the Nazi German army came into that area and invaded and took all of those Ukrainian people, or a lot of them, and made them work in forced labour camps back in Germany during the war. My grandmother still has an arthritic knee from pushing a pedal that operated a laser that manufactured bullets, and she was forced to do that at gunpoint. At other times, while she was in the camp, after the Allied bombing raids, she'd have to go into the city, I think it was Cologne in Germany, and her and her other counterparts in the camp had to pick up the body parts of people who had died in the bombing raids the night before. When the war ended and they were liberated, my grandmother met my grandfather and they spent 3 years living in a refugee camp in Italy. They had a choice of going to Australia, going to the United States or going to Canada, and they chose Australia. My grandfather came out first because that's what they could only afford, one ticket at that time. My grandmother and my uncle, who was born in Italy, came out 2 years later and settled in Adelaide. My grandfather was a trained shoemaker. He was an artist and he had good skills. But the only job he could get at the time was digging ditches for the government, because immigrants didn't get good jobs at that time. When they walked down the street, people would spit on them and treat them with disdain and call them communists, not understanding that people from Ukraine were fleeing the communist government because they would have been killed if they'd gone back there. So that's the perspective that I bring to viewing the refugee issue. So we'll move on.
If you could ask everyone in this room.
It's a quick question for Bruce. 300,000 people going to Bougainvillea Snowfall, or going through Bougainvillea Snowfall, a pretty large number. Why was Wodonga, or Wodonga kind of region, chosen to bring so many people through, and why now also is it an area that the government sees as
I gave this answer to the first group. You've got to understand that the two railway gauges never meshed. Victoria's railway gauge was 5'3", excuse the old metrics. New South Wales gauge was 4'8.5". So a train couldn't go through from Sydney to Melbourne. Albury and Wodonga grew as change stations. Wodonga, you change the livestock. Albury, you change the passengers. Come war, it's strategically important because railways are a weapon of war. You need to be able to move large numbers of troops quickly. The best place to put the troops you're mustering, the best place to put their munitions, their ordnance, their tanks, everything is at the break of gauge. So you can rush it north or you can rush it south, wherever you need it. So they built an enormous Bougainvillea camp. They built an enormous Bandiana logistics centre. At the end of the war, there's no building materials readily available. What use can we make of these big huts at these places? Bandiana was fine. We keep it up to take all of the army supplies, particularly because we're still worried about a Cold War in Europe, and we were to become worried about a war in Vietnam. Bougainvillea, Arthur Corwell had the dream of increasing the Australian population, and here was ready-made accommodation to use for the migrants, and it could be used simply and easily. Now, Albury-Wodonga would become a focus for first Aboriginal family resettlement in the 1970s, then migrant family resettlement, refugee families, because it was believed to be big enough to cater with jobs. You need not only accommodation, but you need jobs. In recent times, it's become more difficult to get those jobs for refugee people. But other places like Griffith, where there's fruit picking jobs that are fairly readily available, they can go on taking refugees because there's at least some form of labour that doesn't require a great language skill, for example.
Thanks, Simon. Group 5. We've got two candidates here. Who wants it? Yeah. Who wants it? That's group 5.
Yeah, but yeah, we're group 5.
Some girls work hard at being airheads, don't they?
On average, how long would it take to be released in Australia after being
in a could we have that one again and your name again, please?
We were misbehaving at this end. What do you think?
On average, how long would it take to be released into Australia after being in a refugee centre?
And what was your name?
Kristen.
So that's for you. How long?
You are asking me about process for coming here or after coming here to settle. What kind of questions you have?
How long does it take to get to Australia?
After you go to the refugee camp.
Yes. My process starts when I drop the applications, I should go somewhere, third country settlement, not Australia. Third country settlement, that is a program of UNHCR. I drop the application form there, and after 1 year, sorry, 1 month, they call us an interview, and that interview, we pass the interview. And then we decide that after that, when we take give the interview and we pass interview and they give the, you are going to Australia. They decide the country now. And then we are referred to Australian embassy or Australian groups there. We screen there. And then Australian groups keep us 6 months. It is a 6 month period. And that is a different things there. How long? Individual families depend upon this. There is the aware about the some kind of diseases. What kind of diseases I have? I may have that communicable diseases like tuberculosis and all these things. Or I may have suffering from HIV and all these things. Like this sort of health issue coming there. And if the health issue coming there, it may be take 1 year or more than 1 year. So for my case, there is no any health issue come. So I start from the beginning to 6-7 months, I came here. When I start my process, up to 7 months, I come here in Australia. Within 7 months, that's the thing. Is that question for you or another one?
The average distance between applying for a visa and getting a visa is 3 years. Once people have been given a visa and they've passed the medicals, it's another 6 months, usually. They try and make it a bit less than that, if they can, because otherwise they've got to do the medical again, because people might be well at the beginning of 6 months and sick by the end of it. So they try and make it quick. But it's the average time to get all the paperwork and be at the bottom of the pile and get up to the top of the pile. It's 3 years. The people are in the refugee camps and they are not saying, I'm in a refugee camp, I want to go to another country. They're saying, I'm in a refugee camp, I'll stay here till it's safe to go home. And so it's often 10 years before they realise that they are never going to be able to go home and they have to look somewhere else to go. So the duration of time in the camp before they start applying to go elsewhere is quite long.
Okay.
But the average is 3 years once you put in an application, and you've got no guarantee you'll get it. And so you get on with your life, and sometimes you leave the camp. And you get the government gives out more visas than the people arrive, because people knock them back once they've got them.
I think that's a good point in there, is that no one really wants to leave their home. It's what's comfortable, it's what's familiar, it's what they love. So people only leave if they really, really have to and want to come back, unless they really, really can. All right, trip six.
My name is Talia. How do you think refugees adapt to their new country after spending years in a refugee camp?
What's the question?
How do they adjust to ordinary life after being in a camp for so long?
To their new country.
How do they adjust in a normal life after
being in a
refugee camp?
I asked the question.
You asked the question.
Yes, this one is... sometimes it is quite difficult to adapt a new thing. And it is not easy to change like today one type and another day another type. Like now, like that magic like things. It is already constructed in our mind. Our life is what kind of life there. And this constructed things here is changing not quickly. It takes time. It takes time, and sometimes I feel difficulties for this one. What I practice when I was in refugee camp, that one is not easily turned up within a no time. No, there takes time to adapt the things, new things here. Like tell you, like using new technology. I never used this kind of technology before in refugee camp. I never get chance also there. When I come here, I got one computer from universities, and to got take that computer to the home and fix it somehow, but I start to operate, I don't know how to operate. That's the thing. And I start to write and searching the letter A like this. This is the thing. This is the adaptation. I should take time there for practice and come for this one. This train, like this sort of things. Yes, it is hard and take time. It's time take for me. I don't know.
I think there are so many things that are different, even thinking of being a young migrant arrived in Australia. So many cultural differences that you can't begin to count them, little things. One story that I remember a refugee telling me, a refugee who had spent some time in a very strictly controlled refugee camp for political prisoners. And what he said was that he was admitted into hospital in Australia, and he couldn't sleep at night because he was very, very anxious, because the night nurse would come around and check that everyone was asleep by shining a torch in their face. Now, shining a torch in someone's face in the prison camp that he had experienced was something that made you think, okay, am I the next one to be taken out and executed? So a little thing that for us, it's really normal. Nurses are looking after us. No, it's something caring. For that person, was really a difficult experience. So there can be tiny little things in life that we're not even consciously aware of, that are really difficult for people to adjust to.
Penny might have some other comments to make.
Bruce.
I'm just thinking about one young man, and he's when he landed in Australia, he had good oral English and got himself a job quite quickly working with, you know, the kids that find it hard to live at home and the government takes them and puts them in a home, and he was working as a house parent. He'd only been in Australia a week and he had this job. He had a driver's licence and he, one of the kids wanted to get some McDonald's. So he, they went off to McDonald's and it said drive through, so he did. And the kid started screaming, "You're supposed to stop, you're supposed to stop," because he just went in the entrance and went out the exit because it said drive through. So he was very confused about all sorts of things. He's now, he's got two jobs. He's studying. He was went to TAFE and now he's at uni. He's also working to establish a group that will send money back to an orphanage that his brother and a friend have started in the place where they came from, because there are so many kids who have lost their parents and are not getting education, and they're wanting to set up a school for these kids. This is a guy who's also just he's married, he's got two kids. And his written English is atrocious, but he hasn't got time to learn his written English. So, because, believe it or not, he's got a lot of other things to do. And one of the big burdens for him is just fitting everything in.
If you can imagine getting on a train at the Albury Railway Station and travelling a long, long way through the night, and then when you get off the train at the other end, you don't know where you are, you don't speak the language, you don't have any idea of how to get where you're going, you don't even really know where you're going. So it's that sort of a displacement that affects every aspect of your life when you go somewhere as a displaced person, I think.
So again, put yourself in these people's shoes, imagine what it would be like for you, the best way to try and get a good point.
I'm Chelsea. How many different cultures are there in Australia due to refugees?
Due to refugees? Migrants as well.
including migrants, I think the number at the moment is about 200, but... yeah, that's roughly about 200 different kinds of national groups represented.
Hands up if you have a migrant background in your family.
Everyone.
All right, unless you are an Aboriginal person, you should all have your hands up.
My name's Nicole, and what other criminal activity does people's mother fund?
I didn't hear the beginning, the question.
Again, Tyler.
What other criminal activity does people's mother fund?
What other criminal activities
does...
You're thinking about drugs or something?
Any links to other forms of organised crime?
I think it must be really hard to say, I don't know, because the criminal... The people smugglers who get caught, I suppose, are the only ones who could tell us that. I don't really know.
I think it's important to understand that the number of people who arrive by boat as refugees is tiny according to the number of people who arrive other ways. So don't always think refugee, boat people. Mm. Not necessarily so.
Maybe I'm better in a better position to answer this, being a security person. If you think about the people that actually drive the boats, they're just fishermen, get hired out.
It's the people above them that are doing the hiring, and the people above them, again, who are actual participants in organised crime. It's the people at that level that are involved in drugs, that are involved in prostitution and sex slavery and that kind of thing. So people smuggling is part of a much larger matrix of organised crime around the world.
And some of them are just heroes, like Schindler's List.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. So I think we're up to group 8, are we?
9?
You know, Benjamin, he doesn't live. He walks up a steep hill and he doesn't live to slow down. He's still there.
I'm sorry.
Kylie, I think.
What are some of the challenges of migrants face when they come to Australia, and what are the supports in place for them?
What family challenges and what are the supports in place for them? Yes.
What family challenges and supports in place?
Some of the challenges. Where do we start? Do you want to? Many challenges.
Yes. I found many challenges. As I mentioned before also, coming in a new place and sitting in that new place, that is one challenge. We should not know the surrounding, who are there, who is the neighbor. That is also who we don't know, one thing. And there is cultural differences. And that difference also challenges. And then another one is day-to-day activities, what that particular person's doing, that habit they have. And next one is different habit. That is also another challenge. And another challenge is food also, another challenge. What usually I am taking in when I was in refugee camps, and I may not get the same type of food or same things in here also. Like differences of food also, language, skill, many challenges there.
Okay.
Many challenges. So to learn this everything, we have to go to some this kind of institute. Or go to the other area like a working place somewhere and just for a while to go and assimilate the big groups and learn from there and act like that one. That is the things.
I think one of the things that that is also a big challenge is that in Australia, there are so many different systems that we have to know about.
Yes.
We have to know about how to get a Medicare card. What do you use a Medicare card for? Who do you pay and who do you don't pay when you go to a hospital or a doctor? How do you actually enrol your children in school? How do you enrol in university? How do you get a driver's license? How do you set up a bank account? There are so many systems that people have to actually learn in order to be able to live in a society like Australia. And maybe, Penny, you can talk about the support systems that are in place.
Yes, I think one of the challenges that it comes is for families, that you've come to a strange country and you know how to live and you know how to raise your children. The children go out and mix with the other people in the community and come home with new ideas, as everyone does. But often those ideas, and I'm just thinking about the challenges of how we regard the independence of young people in our society. For many countries, young people are kept much more within the families, and they don't have the go out at night. ideas. I know with one family, one of the struggles is that there are school excursions where she will be going away from the school, and they really can't understand why there's not, the people aren't just at the school. That's quite a challenge, that their daughter is going with strangers away. And that's very hard for them to bear. The support services, the government have this humanitarian settlement scheme, and they organise St Vincent de Paul, Anglicare, various organisations they have tendered, and they get funding from the government to organise volunteers. So when a new family arrives, there will be a team, ideally a team of five or six people, but sometimes if a community stretch, there'll be two, who will meet them, show them what you do with an oven, what's a fridge for, why you don't stick a fork in the toaster, how to fill out the forms, where to find things in town. So for 6 months at least, people will be actively involved in supporting people in finding their way around, normalising until they become able to find their own way. So 6 months is too little time, but it's a start. And by then, hopefully, people have made connections. Yeah.
I just want to add something in regards to educational experiences. Like, Chura has a refugee background, but I moved 5 years ago, but I don't have any refugee background. I've grown up in a northern state of India called as Punjab, which is quite rich state, and learned all the things back home in India. Learned 3 different languages from my prep up to year 10. And I did my study in English medium in year 11, 12, and then did masters and all other degrees up there. But in terms of moving to Australia, 5 years ago when I moved to Australia, it was a bit challenging for me too. Like, trying to fit into a new society. People having a different way of living, different style. And then because I had education in my life, so and also a practice of English language in my house as well as in my university, so I was able to cope quite quickly. So what I did is I purposefully planted myself in a customer service job called as well, working for Tsunami's company at Melbourne. So working in that company for near and half, working in a Portuguese industry, helped me to develop my skills and then eventually able to fit into the place where I wanted to. So I planned, I worked in a customer service job, talked to the people from different culture, different backgrounds, so that I can understand how do they think, how do they talk. So learned a lot of new things from them, learned how do they talk, and then I tried to copy that behaviour. Somehow I tried to learn from things and try to put into my lifestyle so that I can be I can fit into the society. So if all that experience in the first 2 years working into a different workplace, chose to work in a place where I was able to speak more and more English. But if I might not have done that, I would not be in a place where I am right now. So it took me 2 years to learn new things. It took me 2 years to learn different way of thinking, learning how people behave, what are their values, what are the food they eat, so that I can have that in my life as well, and so that quickly I can feel it. So it took me less time because if I had a language experience in my life, so I learned 3 languages, so that helped me to fit in easily. And I've grown up in a nation where there is diversity already, so like India, where we have nearly 28 states, people from different states have a different language, different food. So that those types of values and those type of experience help me to fit in quickly. While for Chura, it's very challenging because he had no experience in his life. He had no experience of experiencing different languages in his life. And now for him, he has grown up with one language, and now he needs to learn a new language to learn whatever happening around him so that he can fit into the society.
One of the support systems available is also English language classes.
I'm sorry, I missed an important thing.
That's a really important basic one.
I think the point of one of the things that Cindy's brought up there is when you're a migrant to a new country, you can't just bumble through life like an idiot, like a lot of people do in Australia. You have to think strategically about where you want to go. And that's something that we would very much encourage you to do yourself. Well, I've got time for one more question. So, group 10.
I thought we were going to 240.
Excellent.
We only had nine groups.
Cool.
No.
This is our group belief that we believe that our views, like Australia's view, that they think that refugees shouldn't be allowed in Australia. Have you faced like or experienced that?
Have you encountered people who are saying refugees shouldn't be in Australia?
Have you faced any prejudice?
How do you
cope with people who say there should be no refugees? Go home.
Ready? Yeah, I think so.
I'm thinking that that may be some person's right also. So I can't say that. Somebody must accept me now. Somebody may reject me also. That's the things. That is why if somebody say like that, a refugee must not come in Australia, say like this also, it is not wrong. They may have their own ideology, they may have their own thinking. That's the things. That is dear. And some people say we need refugees because we have big space here and we need populations. That is also another true things coming here. And I personally feeling of that one is if somebody saying that refugee is not no more here in Australia, like that sort of statement coming here, must look outside the world. What is going on outside the world? And if there is something good in this side, there must be the bad in another side. If you got chance, yesterday's SBS 3 programs like Bhutan's, if you got the chance to see these ones, how beautiful things shows in this side. It is beautiful. I can accept that some changes was there in Bhutan, but backside is mine. I was the one of the victim of there. That's the things. So, yes, everything have dear rights. If somebody says that is no more refugee in here, that is also their right. They have their own ideology, they have their own thought. Maybe that I don't feel that is sad. Oh, you are hurting me. No. That is, I should accept that one. And if somebody love me, that is also good. Okay, you know my feeling. That's the things.
Okay, unfortunately, we'll have to wrap up there. Can you give the panelists a round of applause?
Thank you.
together, I'd like to really thank the Australian staff, in particular Dr. Pamela Wallace and Dr. Anthony Habib. It's been a lot of logistics and organising. Also, thanks to the catering staff, Ms. Russ, and to the panel for coming. We know you're busy people, we thank you for that. To the Australian students, and also to the teachers that helped pull together, thank you very much. Now, hopefully, not only will we learn from this day about refugees and migration through where we've been in our talk and discussion here, but also hopefully you've also got a bit of an idea of what goes on at university, and hopefully this is the start of more involvement at the university and between our school and the university as well. So let's put our hands together. Thank you, folks. What we are going to do, we're going to put aside 3 or 4 minutes just to do this. There's a questionnaire. Can we do that here?
Yeah.
We're going to hand out a little questionnaire to say what you've been planning and what we're working on. Thank you. And after we flip that up,
I actually ordered some and I haven't appeared, so maybe I didn't order them.
Thank you very much for coming. That's really appreciated. That's what I'm going to do.
diversity, and more importantly, growing your understanding and realizing that refugees are but people like ourselves, and we are all deserving of being treated in the same way. Now, I'd also just like to thank the La Trobe, what do we call it, partnership program. Today would not happen without the sponsorship and funding of the program. Excuse me up there. You listen? Thank you. This is quite serious business. There has been money provided for this, and we've been able to partake of that. And not only financially has this been able to be been delivered, but certainly your teachers, I know your teachers have put an awful lot of time into this, as have our panel of experts. Thank you so very much, and our students to my left. Thank you. Hope you enjoy the day.